So this morning we're reading from Proverbs chapter 9, verse 7 to 12. Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker, or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. Instruct a wise man, and he will be wiser still. Teach a righteous man, and he will add to his learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For through me your days will be many, and years will be added to your life. If you are wise, your wisdom will reward you. If you are a mocker, you alone will suffer.
Well, this is the last opportunity we have to spend time with Dr. Cindy Parker. How many of you were at the breakfast yesterday? Yeah, great. We had 90 people at our breakfast, and it was just so good. Cindy is an Old Testament professor living in Philadelphia. She is starting a very cool business/ministry where she will help church people understand Jesus and the Bible better by understanding the unique cultural context of the Bible. And today we're going to get a little bit of that. It's been so great to have you, Cindy. What fun we've had the last 10 days.
So much fun.
And let's say thank you for the investment that Cindy's made.
Thank you. Thank you. I have very much enjoyed being not only a part of this community for the last over a week, but seeing your amazing city, which truly is glorious. I have eaten well, which is wonderful. I love the food aspect, which is really great because it also all builds up to today because we're talking about food all day, which is really very fun. So I'm talking today, everything we're talking about is out of Proverbs chapter 9. And before we get there, I would ask you, if you're thinking about the Old Testament, what do you normally think about? And almost always people first tell me war, which makes all of us very uncomfortable. It's just one of those things about the Old Testament that is super uncomfortable that makes us want to dismiss it. And it also means that we don't read it a whole lot in church because you don't really know what to do with slaughter every third person. You're like, that's just awkward. I don't know the application point, to that particular example. So we think of war. We also tend to think about the kings. So we might talk about and retell the stories of Saul, of David, of Solomon, maybe, and compare characters. Or we think about the temple. So holiness codes, what are the laws, all these sacrifices, God's presence in the temple. Right? So we tend to focus on these really big, almost nationalistic type qualities, and we tend to lose the story of the common person in the common place. And it's not that those stories aren't there. We have all kinds of stories. And if we really are intentional about digging, we can even find the stories about women and children. It's just sometimes they're unnamed people. Like there's a servant girl that changes the whole course of one of the massive wars that the kingdom of Israel was fighting. We never tell her story. Right, so these stories are all there. We just have to be intentional about looking for them. And the problem is we don't because we, like the biblical writers, like the stories of war, kings, and temples because they're just grandiose. And we just like the grandiose stories. Today, however, we're going to bring it down to the common person. And so we're looking at the book of Proverbs, which is a part of the Israelite wisdom literature. So wisdom literature is a way for us to get a look into the wisdom that was passed down generation to generation. It's a very like common person kind of a piece of writing. And wisdom literature is a little bit like looking at abstract art. Right? Like there's a really beautiful painting But the story of it isn't obvious. And it invites the people who are the viewers to stop and be intentional and ask themselves, what am I thinking about? What am I feeling? What does this mean? It invites intentionality. So medieval monks used to talk about wisdom literature as needing to take wisdom literature, take this poetry, and chew on it like little bits of spices until they pop open and you can get a sense of their deep flavor. Right? So again, it's like a riddle. You have to ponder it. So it's not just this story you read and it's really fun. It's something you mull over. It's supposed to stay with you and kind of roll around in your head for just a little bit. So this is what we're doing. We're looking at Proverbs 9 in particular. And you could argue, if you were to turn with me to Proverbs chapter 1, the very introduction of the book, Proverbs 1, the very first verse says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel." And that right there might make you go, oh, never mind, this is a palace text, right? This is something, it's not really for us, it's for the elite of society, right? And actually what it is the biblical writer saying, in our history, Solomon is the one that we've said was so wise. So let's make a collection of all of our wisdom literature, and let's just say this falls under the category of Solomon. So this is the Solomonic type wisdom, the depth of that kind of wisdom. All we have to do really is start reading the book of Proverbs. And if you read Proverbs 1 through 9, and then again chapter 31, so these framing chapters of the book, all kinds of women show up. Wisdom is there. Folly is there. The strange woman is there. The sage is there. The mother and the wife are there. They are individuals in the home and in the community. So what this actually tells us is as all of this wisdom literature is collected and put together, they're framing it in terms of it's actually, we're going to say, yeah, it's the type of Solomonic wisdom that exists, but it's the wisdom that belongs to us, common people in our common place, right? This is for our home. This is for our city. And it's these framing chapters that tell us that's how we should read it. These framing chapters are also quite interesting because they're quite long poetry, texts of poetry, which is different as soon as you get into chapter 10, 11, 12. Then you start to get all the quotes that we're accustomed to, right? The raise your child in the way that they should go and they will not depart. You know, these really quick, tiny things, little one sentence clips of something that stick in your head and you're like, oh yeah, okay, this is wisdom. We can't read the opening chapters of Proverbs that way because they're much more extensive and they invite a lot more intentionality and purposefulness on our part. So that's what we're going to do. The portion that was read right before I came up here is the very middle portion of Proverbs 9. So there's this little insert into the middle of the proverb that is actually telling us the lesson that is available for us. It's a choice. It's the life that is available. It's kind of the wisdom, the fear of the Lord is wisdom, right? That's the little nugget, and that's found right in the middle, but that interrupts a community story. So Proverbs 9 is actually about a community. And so when we read Proverbs 9, we're actually looking at an invitation, two different invitations, actually. We have wisdom, who invites us in for a meal, and we have folly, who invites us in for a meal. And this is the choice. Who are you going to choose to dine with? I don't mean to say you all are folly. That was circumstantial. So, sorry. My apologies. I think you're all very wise. However, so we have wisdom's invitation, we have folly's invitation, with this little right in the middle, don't forget the wisdom, the fear of the Lord is wisdom, but it leaves it open-ended for you to chew on, which meal am I going to eat? So it's really quite fun. So we're going to do, we're going to look at these invitations, and these invitations either lead to life or they lead to death. Now, this making a choice and life and death wrapped up in the food concept is not unique to Proverbs 9. We could say all you have to do is turn to the very first three chapters of the Bible. And in the Garden of Eden, in this great epic story of the beginning of all things, there is a very significant choice that comes from what you eat and what you don't eat. And it is life or death. It is good, it is evil. And because I had to find a way to get Deuteronomy in here, because Deuteronomy is my thing. Deuteronomy mimics this exact concept. So Deuteronomy, in talking about what is the fear of the Lord, what is loving God with all of your being, what is honoring God in all things, what does that actually mean? At the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, it says you now have a choice, and it's the choice that's given to the entire community. So the whole community has a choice. The choice is good and life, or the choice is evil and death. And it's all in how you choose to love God, how you choose to learn from his commands, how you choose to modify your behavior to be just like him. Right, so Deuteronomy also is going to say, hey, good and life, they go together. Evil and death, they go together. And now we have Proverbs 9, who's saying you have the exact same choice. We're just going to wrap it up in a community story. So we get this community story where the placedness of this story is really significant. And because we are modern, Western, North American, and individualistic people, that's just how we've grown up, not bad, just identifiers of who we are, we need a little bit of a let's rehearse who we are, or what the biblical concept was. Let's rehearse maybe how biblical people, how Israelites maybe would have read or heard or chewed on Proverbs 9. So just to get us into the context, we need to remember that the land the Israelites lived in was marginal land. Meaning to the north and to the south, you have riverine communities that are very lush, and it's easy to have agriculture, and it's easy to build empire-dominating kingdoms. The land Israel lived in was very marginal. It felt all of the effects of the Mediterranean Sea and a lot of effects from the Arabian Desert, and it smashed right in between those two. And the people who lived there developed a sense of subsistence living. Whatever I grow this year is what I eat this year. You don't have extra. So if your crops fail this year, you're hungry all year. Water is a massive consideration too, because water is not a guarantee. Water is just however much it happens to rain that year. And the rainy season is only half the year. So you only have half the year to collect and store as much water as you possibly can to get you through the dry season. So everyone is always thinking about water. And if you're aware of that, or if you've ever been in this kind of scenery, and if you've ever been on a hike with me where you're there for a very long time, you end up going, I'm so thirsty. I'm like, now we can talk about Israelites. This is how the Israelites felt. Their land is dry, and you are just always thirsty. So you are always aware of how much water there is at any given time. Last week, we talked a little bit about the village nature, about how you're always going to have like little plots of land, family land, and you're always caring for your progeny, like how many children you have to take on the family name. So the idea of maintaining family property, which might be really small, And right beyond the family property, there might be shepherding territory way out there in the hinterland. But you're caring a lot about your land. You care a lot about being able to provide for your kids because your kids are the next generation. And so when you care for your land, you're actually making sure that your kids can survive, right? The way I treat my land is going to make it healthy enough for my kids to survive, and then maybe we exist one more generation. So this subsistence living, the idea that we do this together as a community, that our community involvement is essential for the way all of us get to survive, this is what underscores everything about Proverbs 9 and a whole lot of stuff that we tend to miss when we read it too quickly and we don't take time to chew and just let it pop open with flavor. So in this kind of subsistence living, where existence can be quite hard, the role of the women is very important. Women were social actors in the community. We don't see them a lot in the biblical text, and so we kind of just ignore them because they're kind of off over there. But women were really important. So they were able to build relationships across households. So different daily tasks like grinding grain, making bread, baking bread. These were all communal activities. And so because the women were together, they built relationships across family households, which means they were very important social actors. And they played a really significant part in the socioeconomic health and the political health of every village. So this too, the Israelites would have understood. And so when you have wisdom showing up as a female, it's not all that obscure or all that weird, because they would be accustomed to the undergirding of every society is in these networks that the women have. Okay, so now let's start looking at the context of place and as it pertains specifically to wisdom. So we're going to do wisdom, and then we're going to look at folly. Okay, so turn with me to Proverbs 9. So Proverbs 9 starts right away with wisdom. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. You might have a different word, because the hewn out pillars can also mean she erected seven pillars. So it all kind of depends on who your translator is, whatever the translation is. It could be either one. Basically, what we get right away is wisdom is active. She is building her house. And the seven pillars aspect of her house is a little bit of a conundrum in terms of scholars are going to say 1,000 different things depending on their perspective they bring to the text. It can mean that wisdom, when she's building, because she has seven pillars, it seems to hearken back to 7 days of creation, or seven is a perfect number. And because if you read chapter 8, wisdom is the first element of creation. So it has this cosmological type idea. So maybe as wisdom is building her house, maybe it actually is this big, like almost building an actual house, but maybe it's referring to all of creation. Maybe. And a lot of people go down that road. You could also say, if we look at ancient Near Eastern temples, and if you look at archaeology, there are all kinds of temples all over the place in the Near East where huge temples to other gods have seven columns. And so there's almost she's almost building a temple-like structure, wisdom in the temple, which is really interesting concept. And it could rival what other ancient Near Eastern people were doing. Their people are building their temples to their gods. Wisdom is building a different kind of temple. It could be that. And it very well could be, because we call Israelite homes pillared houses, because they had pillars in them, although they usually only have 3 or 4. So people maybe just read this as, she has a huge house. Like, even if it is just a normal Israelite pillared house, to have seven columns just means it's gigantic, which means there's room for everyone to come, right? Because it's just, it's that big. Okay, so we continue. And if we're thinking about the idea that wisdom could be, especially if we bring in the Deuteronomy idea, if wisdom is how people are choosing to live their normal life according to God's laws, it would almost be the aspect of it's not just the laws you mentally agree are good laws, it's what you're actually enacting, how you're actually being, the actions that you do. And so if wisdom is the embodiment of God's law in each individual, in each house, and in the community, we should look at all the action words associated with wisdom, right? So again, in your text, your translation might be different because there's also, when we're working with Hebrew poetry, it can be a little bit odd to turn it into English. It's incredibly beautiful and really succinct in Hebrew, but it normally takes 5 or 6 English words for every 3 Hebrew words. And so in Hebrew, you get this doom, doom, doom idea, and then it changes, and it's beautiful. We lose just a little bit, not a lot, but we lose just a little bit of that artistry when we're looking in English. But we can still pick out a few really interesting ideas. Okay, so action word: she has already built a house. She has already erected her pillars. She has prepared her food. It's actually, she has slaughtered her meat. Right, so a lot of English translations don't say that because they don't put the woman in charge of slaughtering, which is an interesting choice translators are making. But it actually is, she is slaughtering her beast, actually. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her maidens, and she calls. Right, so even just there, like in these short little verses, look at all those action words, all these things that she has done. We get the idea that wisdom is embodying her managerial role in her house or temple or the cosmology, or, you know, she is in charge and she is leaving the home environment to go out into the community. Go out, send out this invitation. And then all the young maidens, the unmarried girls, basically, that she has in her house become extensions of her in the community. Go out. And then she also goes out. And then she offers this invitation. So let's read the invitation. She calls from the tops of the heights of the city, whoever is naive or sometimes simple-minded. Right? So to people who don't know any better, right? They're the ones who get to have this invitation. And there's no judgment in this kind of invitation. It's just for all of those who have not yet made the choice of which meal they're going to eat, this invitation is for you. Let him turn aside here. So she calls the person to action. To him who lacks understanding, she says, come, eat my food, drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake your folly and live, and proceed in the way of understanding. And so at the very last bit of her invitation, we're hearing that the wisdom, the fear of God is wisdom, right? We're going to choose to come, experience my generous hospitality, eat of my food, and then leave no longer naive, but leave wise. And notice how there's an aspect of leaving to then go back out into the community. So there's really something beautiful about wisdom's invitation, because if we think of her home as being really huge and we're really large and available to host a lot of people, she pulls them in, but then she sends them back out. And the communal aspect of that is they can come and feast on her meal, but they leave and they go back out, and there's something healthy about the community that's a result of the hospitality she has just offered. Okay, we should maybe compare this to folly. So we have to skip the middle teaching that we read earlier, and you're going to have to jump down to verse 13. And in verse 13, when we're dealing with folly, it says, "The woman folly is boisterous." Okay, now again, there's a whole lot of translators' interpretation that shows up in the next couple adjectives they use. Boisterous, raucous, loud, anything that has something to do with like an obnoxious. Can you maybe move the slide forward one? Yeah, there we go, perfect. So they might say something like brash, loud, she's rowdy, right? The Hebrew word actually does have a little bit of that connotation. All of these words come from an association with Proverbs 7, where the prostitute is out in the street yelling out to people to come. And so interpreters are basically saying we're choosing to connect Proverbs 9 with Proverbs 7. And we're just going to borrow the words we used in Proverbs 7, even if it's maybe not the best for this particular psalm. I would argue, I think these are a little bit too strong, but let's just say she's boisterous, right? So we kind of get this idea of a charismatic or quite loud character. Okay, so this is the interesting part. So the woman folly is boisterous. The next half of your verse tells you a whole lot about your Bible interpreter. She is something and knows nothing. And whatever that is will tell you how Bible interpreters are interpreting the Hebrew. The correct word is naive. And some of yours might have naive. Some of yours might have seductive. Interesting, right? They're interpreting her character for us, and they're reading into the text, again, because of what we see earlier in Proverbs 7. Seductive, I somewhat understand the choice, but I don't think it's a good choice for using it, because what we miss is wisdom went out and called to all who are naive. And so now we're seeing folly is naive. Folly is the perfect audience for wisdom. In other words, folly is one who has chosen not to respond to wisdom, has not made a change in action. I think that comparison is so important. And when we just toss it away as, oh, she's just seductive, she's the seductress who's pulling in the single men and destroying community, we're missing the bigger point. The bigger point is folly did not respond to wisdom, and now folly is offering her own invitation. Right? You see, it's different, don't you think? I think it's totally different. And it gives us a different idea about the quality, the character of these women. Okay, so let's do the same thing that we did with wisdom. So if wisdom is the embodiment of and the living out of God's law in our personal lives, our private home life, and in the community, then let's look at all the action words associated with folly. Remember the huge list with wisdom? Folly sits at her doorway. There is no verb almost anywhere else except for her calling out. There's no verb. So there will be a verb in your English translation because they have to supply it. The Hebrew is really awkward. There's nothing. She sits. Remember, wisdom built her house. Folly sits in the doorway of her house. And then she yells from there. There's no managerial aspect of what folly is doing. So in verse 14, she sits at the doorway of her house. Ooh, and you know what's really interesting? If we were to borrow Israelite imagination, which there's no way to know I'm doing correctly, but I like my imagination, and I like Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy says that the Israelites should post at liminal places God's word. So on your forearm, in the middle of your forehead, on the doorposts of your house, and on the city gates. Right? And that's part of how the community is supposed to live to remember God's law. So if we're all Israelites and we're like, ooh, look at this. Folly is sitting at the doorway of her house. Ideally, God's law is posted at the doorway of her house. And the contrast now is she is sitting doing nothing underneath the written word of what she's supposed to be doing. Isn't that fun? Yeah, see? Israelite imagination. Stick with the Parker version, and you never know where you're going to go. Okay, so she sits at the doorway of her house, and then it doesn't even repeat the verb. It just says she sits on a seat at the high place in the city. So now she's mimicking wisdom, who is also at the high place of the city. And she calls to those who pass by, also mimicking wisdom. Except that the people she calls to are making their paths straight. So they are people who are on the way. And she calls to distract them to bend in towards her place. And it's interesting because there's so little information about her home that you kind of have to, it's in the Parker imagination. It is like a dimly lit house that you can't quite see into. Because we don't really know, like seven pillars for wisdom, a table that is laden, servants who are working, folly, we're like, peering in, can't quite see, it's a little bit obscure, and we will find out pretty soon that it is a trap. But that is already laid for us in the way this poem is written. So she is calling to those who pass by, who are making their path straight. This is verse 16 now. Whoever is naive, also calling to the same people, let him turn in here. Let him who lacks understanding and to him who lacks understanding, she says. And now she's going to tell you her menu. But I want you to wait. Let's go back to wisdom. If we think again in Israelite context, what is it that they normally eat? Well, you eat an awful lot of bread. You have so lots of grains in different forms, various spices, lots of vegetables, meat every once in a great while. Wine, water, of course, is super important. When we're looking at menus, you basically could just eat your way through the Bible because biblical people love food, which is great. That's very like-minded. So if you read through the menus, you know if it's a feast or if it's a regular meal just based on what they're eating. So if we go back to wisdom, look at all the stuff she's prepping for. She's prepared her food. She has slaughtered her beast. Meat is on the menu. We have just elevated our normal meal to a feast because we're eating atypical things, things that aren't normally on the menu. We're now eating, and so now it's a special meal. She has mixed her wine. She's set her table. In other words, the table is meant to be feasted on visually before people even come and physically feast at her table. And she's inviting them to wisdom, and she's inviting them to go back out into the community. And there's a health and a wholeness that is there because of her generosity. Okay, now let's look at what folly says she is offering. So she's trying to tell people, turn in here to my dimly lit house. That's the Parker version. And she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. And if we pause, water and bread are at the core of the Israelite diet. So let's look at the qualities of these two things. Stolen water. Wow, okay, so again, a lot of translators will then say, oh, this is a euphemism for sexual improprieties. Like she's basically saying she's inviting people in to taste of her stolen waters. They actually have to bend a whole bunch of things to make their argument work, and I don't like that argument. I do think there is a slight undercurrent of that being there. I think it's slightly there. But I think it's a low level of what's there. I think if we were Israelites, I think the power of the analogy is in the plain sense meaning of the word. Stolen water is sweet. This is a community that is thirsty at all times. This is a community that has half of the year to store water to get them through the dry season. If she's saying stolen water, She has taken water from elsewhere in the community to serve at her house, which is extremely not only self-indulgent, but community-destroying. So the stolen water, I think, you know, maybe this other layer, but I think the shocker is she dares to steal the water and then serve it and then to say, oh, it's so sweet. So what about bread in secret? Well, I already mentioned the bread making, grinding of the grain, making the loaves, baking the bread. These are all communal activities that the women have done. And now she's like, bread in secret. There's nothing about what Folly is doing that means she has engaged the community. And so now Folly is asking people to come off the path into her house where they can partake of things that if we were Israelites, we would say those are very destructive to the community, larger community thing. And Folly's trying to go, oh, no, it's totally okay. Like, it's great. It'll taste sweet and you're going to love it. Okay, but then we get to the very last part of the proverb. In verse 18, it says, but he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. Right, so again, remember the dimly lit house? You can't quite tell who's there. Now there's something about Folly inviting people in. And again, the complete opposite to wisdom, who invited people in, fed them, nourished them, sent them back out into the community. Folly's going, hey, come on in. Everything we're eating, everything we're doing is destructive to our community. And actually, as soon as you come in, death is there. You're socially eating with those who are already dead. Oh, it's such a powerful proverb. And then it ends, like, really dramatically. And so there's something about the way it just dramatically ends that makes us think, oh, this is our call to action. Like, now we've been presented with the choice. And we've had this really amazing, nourishing version, and we've had this super destructive version, but the invitation still stands. Choose one of them. Go eat with one of them. But by placing them side by side, you really get the idea that the person who chooses Folly is quite foolish because they've chosen not to be nourished, not to be healthy. They've chosen to go and die. So this idea of being invited to the table and feasting at the table is not just like physically going and feasting somewhere with wisdom or Folly. It's whose teachings are you going to ingest? Are you going to ingest the teachings of wisdom, or will you ingest and embody the teachings of Folly? And the choice is yours to make. So wisdom truly is the fear of the Lord, and wisdom is also life. And that is the conclusion we're supposed to come to, but you're still left with your own individual choice that has to be made. And so in light of that, I brought spices with me this morning. They're anise seeds. So often, like when you go out for Indian food and then you leave and you just dump a little pile in your hand and eat them. They're at the back, on the back tables. I would invite you to go and just take a little spoonful and pop them in your mouth. Chew on them like you would chew on wisdom. Let the flavor pop, because it'll pop, and then it'll linger and it'll last. And as it follows in your mouth until you go eat your next meal, may it remind you of the way that we are supposed to chew on wisdom and think about wisdom and lean into wisdom. And then at the end of the day, we're making choices about how we're choosing to live life and if are those choices healthy, not only for the individual, but for the larger community as well. So may it walk out the door with you. Now, before then, we have another table that is set. And we have another table we get to feast from. And these flavors get to linger in our mouth as well. And so may these, as you take and as you partake, may these flavors also be ingested so that you're ingesting the full embodiment of what is laid before you. Thanks.